Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, the Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. This program is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. Question number one. What happened on this day back in 1969 at a White House concert by the Turtles and the Temptations? Was it A, the lead vocalist and guitarist of the Turtles fell off the stage 5 times? Was it B, the Temptations disbanded halfway through the concert? Was it C, Vietnam protesters were invited into the White House by Trisha Nixon? Was it D, Vice President Spiro Agnew called in the National Guard to arrest the performers? Or was it E, all of the above happened on this day at the White House concert? 1969? What really happened at the White House concert anyway? And question number two, how did Mick Jagger of the Rolling Stones respond on this very day to the news of an earthquake in Nicaragua? Was it A, he wrote the song, I Feel the Earth Move, which Carole King later recorded? Was it B, he performed Shake, Rattle, and Roll at a concert? Was it C, he added $150,000 of his own money to the $350,000 already raised by a Rolling Stones benefit concert for the victims of the earthquake? Or was it D, he did all of the above on this very day back in 1973? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of May the 9th. Well, it was on this very day, back in 1957, that Buddy Holly and the Crickets auditioned for Arthur Godfrey's Talent Scouts, and they were rejected. 1957, today. And it was 50 years ago today, 1975, that Stevie Wonder and his band, Wonderlove, played for 125,000 people at the Washington Monument as part of Human Kindness Day. Stevie Wonder, half a century ago today. Vivaldi's Spring introduces our classical music news. Today, the conclusion of the March 25, 2025 article, published in BBC Music magazine titled, He Rode His Motorbike Naked into the Village, which we started reading 2 weeks ago. That article was subtitled 15 Very Badly Behaved Composers, from Mozart to Peter Warlock. Here are 15 composers who stepped out of line, socially, sexually, or just with too much motorbike-based nudity. So here are the final 4 featured composers from that article. Coming in at number 13, Carlo Gesualdo. his bad behavior. There's no almost this time. Gesualdo was a bona fide murderer. Unlike Berlioz, the 16th century Italian composer, Carlo Gesualdo actually carried out this murderous intent. When he discovered his wife and the Duke of Andria at his palace in 1590, he did not hesitate to draw the knife, and so earned himself the reputation of the most notorious composer of all time. This being Renaissance Italy, however, and with Gesualdo's coming from noble stock, his crime went relatively unpunished. In those days, it was all about mixing within the right circles. This is another case where it's perhaps important to separate the man from the music, as Gesualdo's murderer, though he was, also composed some of his era's most sublime and somewhat eerie music. Then number 14, Lord Berners. Bad behavior? He was, shall we say, not a champion of animal rights. Quite how composer Gerald Tyrwhitt, better known as Lord Berners, escaped the attention of the RSPCA is anyone's guess. His delight in catching pigeons, painting them various colors, and making them wear masks has already been mentioned in this publication. Previously unremarked upon in these pages, however, has been the sign erected at his house warning that trespassers will be prosecuted, dogs shot, cats whipped, or more disturbingly, the occasion when he dropped his mother's dog out of a window to see if it would fly. The eccentric Brit clearly had a ghoulish fascination with living things falling from high places, deciding to build a 100-foot viewing tower in his garden, he accompanied it with another ominous sign, "Members of the public committing suicide from this tower do so at their own risk." And finally, number 15, Peter Warlock and E.J. Moran. Bad behavior? Various. Finally, on to the great double act of badly behaved composers. If the people of Eynsford, Kent, initially welcomed seeing two such prestigious characters as Peter Warlock and E.J. Moran move into a house in their village in the mid-1920s, their opinion soon changed. Hopes of the dulcet strains of the piano or a nice chamber music recital wafting from the windows were dashed as the air reverberated instead to the sound of yet another bottle being opened or the cries of pleasure from three in-a-bed sessions. Not that the pair kept the fun within four walls, with Moran's antics including drunkenly driving his car into a hedge, and Warlock, he chose to shock the locals by riding into the village on a motorbike naked. This article initially appeared in the December 2021 issue of BBC Music Magazine. And in music research and technology, we have this article. This is Your Brain on Music, The Science of a Human Obsession. This is by Daniel Levitin, August 27, 2007, and it's given 4.25 out of 5 possible stars by an Amazon.com review. In this groundbreaking union of art and science, rocker-turned-neuroscientist Daniel J. Levitin explores the connection between music, its performance, its composition, how we listen to it, why we enjoy it, and the human brain. taking on prominent thinkers who argue that music is nothing more than an evolutionary accident, Levitin poses that music is fundamental to our species, perhaps even more so than language. Drawing on the latest research and on musical examples, ranging from Mozart to Duke Ellington to Van Halen, he reveals how composers produce some of the most pleasurable effects of listening to music by exploiting the way our brains make sense of the world. Also, why we are so emotionally attached to the music we listened to as teenagers, whether it was Fleetwood Mac, U2, or Dr. Dre. Also, that practice, rather than talent, is the driving force behind musical expertise. And also, how those insidious little jingles called earworms get stuck in our head. A Los Angeles Times Book Award finalist, This Is Your Brain on Music, will attract readers of Oliver Sacks and David Byrne, as it is an unprecedented, eye-opening investigation into an obsession at the heart of human nature. And from forums.pianoworld.com, Monica Kay in August 2005 writes, a fascinating book by Daniel Levitin called This Is Your Brain on Music. Levitin has an interesting story. He started off as a musician and producer, and his book is scattered with anecdotes about the musicians he's worked with in his career. But at some point, he became more interested in understanding how music affects us, and he returned to get a Ph.D. in cognitive neuroscience and works now as a professor at McGill University. This book is broad and comprehensive and covers all aspects of the psychology of music, from the fundamentals of how our ears perceive musical qualities, such as pitch, and where he addresses the age-old question, if a tree fell in a forest and nobody was there, would it make a sound? The answer is no. To more abstract issues of why it is we like the music we do, here's a brief overview of the chapters in this book. Chapter 1, What is Music? This chapter gives an excellent background to defining music, organized sound, and music-related terms such as pitch, rhythm, tempo, contour, timbre, loudness, reverberation, meter, key, melody, etc. Number 2 chapter, Foot Tapping. This chapter discusses rhythm, loudness, and harmony, and talks about the brain structures involved in perceiving rhythm. Chapter 3, Behind the Curtain. This chapter delves more into basic neuroscience principles and talks about consciousness and the mind and how it derives from patterns of neuronal activation. Bottom line, the human brain is very, very complicated. Chapter 4, Anticipation. This chapter explores the role of patterns and expectations in making great music great. Essentially, music involves repetitive patterns we grow to expect after being exposed to music in a given culture. But great music violates our expectations in subtle ways, and that's what makes it great. Chapter 5, You Know My Name, Look Up the Number. This chapter talks about how we categorize music, i.e., how do we know that something is heavy metal song versus new age piece. It covers in some depth basic cognitive psychology theory about how the brain forms categories in the first place. Chapter 6, After Dessert. This chapter involves the role of the reptilian brain, portions of the cerebellum, in music appreciation. Chapter 7, What Makes a Musician? This chapter might prove the most interesting to the AB Forum. Here he talks about expertise and talent in music. He argues that music is a universal human characteristic, and it is only in the past 500 years that a distinction between quote-unquote performers and quote-unquote audience in music has been made. Talent, by the way, is overrated. Most people with raw talent, he argues, are people who have simply practiced a lot. Chapter 8, My Favorite Things. This chapter addresses the question of why we like the music that we like. Interest in music peaks during the adolescence years, and that music tends to be the music we consider, quote-unquote, best later on in life. And Chapter 9, The Music Instinct. Levitin argues that music played an important evolutionary role of its own, primarily in facilitating social bonds as well as signaling reproductive fitness. Last, he provides a couple of appendices showing diagrams of the brain and a primer on music theory. Overall, for anyone more than a passing interest in music, this is an excellent book. Although many of the issues are pretty technical, Levitin makes the neuroscience literature interesting to the lay audience and is able to explain it very clearly. Round Midnight by North Carolina's Thelonious Monk introduces our local music news. It's an article from the North Carolina Noted, listening to the music that shaped our state's history, culture, and people, section of the May 2025 issue of Our State magazine, written by Mark Kemp, entitled Farmville, the Choir Master. Before her voice captivated the world, Roberta Flack, who was born in Black Mountain during Jim Crow, began her career in Pitt County, teaching and encouraging choral students. Roberta Flack's classical training and soulful voice made her a pop star. Years before her songs took over the radio in the early 70s, she taught music in North Carolina. When she was 11 years old and entering the segregated H.B. Sugg School in Farmville in the late 1950s, Alma Hobbs and her classmates were invited by their new music teacher, a classically trained recent Howard University graduate, to audition for their school choir. Hobbs couldn't know at the time that the teacher, Miss Flack, would go on to become one of the biggest musical stars of the 1970s. You see, Miss Flack's first name was Roberta, and in 1972 and 1973, she took the pop world by storm with a pair of gentle, ethereal number one singles, The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face, and Killing Me Softly with his song. On her albums from her 1969 debut, First Take, to her final studio release in 2012, Let It Be, Roberta, Roberta Flack sings the Beatles. Her crisp, clear, and wistful voice would segue effortlessly from polished classical stylings to warm folk ballads, contemplative jazz, simmering soul, and playful funk. By the time of her death in February at age 88, her angelic voice silenced by ALS, Flack had long been credited with helping introduce a smoother, moodier style of R&B known as Quiet Storm. But in 1959, she was only known as Miss Flack, the young teacher born in the mountains of western North Carolina and adored by her students in the endlessly flat eastern part of our state. What Hobbs remembers most about her former teacher is her impressive talent, her bright smile, and her willingness to encourage students who may not have been the greatest singers, but who nonetheless had something to offer a choir. Her philosophy was that everyone does not have to be a singer, but that a choir needs all voices because you're going to blend together, Hobbs says. She laughs. I was one of those voices that blended. Flack got the job through a Howard University classmate. The school needed a choir director and contacted Farmville native Clarence Knight Jr., and he recommended her. It wasn't an easy move for the young musician. Flack was a small child when her family relocated from their hometown of Black Mountain to the Washington, D.C. area. What she recalled most about her southern upbringing was discrimination. Music helped her process her feelings about it. I found solace and took out my frustrations on the piano, she once said. I even recorded a number of North Carolina folk songs that I learned growing up. Hobbs was in college preparing for her own career that eventually led to a lofty position with the U.S. Department of Agriculture when she first heard one of Miss Flack's hit songs at a party. It was unbelievable, she recalls with a cackle, and of course I went and told everyone. I knew that I was in Roberta Flack's choir. Decades later, when Flack the legend performed a concert in Washington, D.C., Clarence Knight brought her elderly mother backstage to reconnect with the singer, and the two of them spent the evening reminiscing about her time in their home. She was here for just 1 year, Hobbs says, but she made an incredible difference. In the Farmville of the 1950s, in the classrooms and hallways of an ordinary all-black school that laid the foundation for several extraordinary lives. The author, Mark Kemp, is senior editor at Our State magazine and a former editor of Rolling Stone and a voting member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So how did you do on today's trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, what happened on this day back in 1969 at a White House concert by the Turtles and the Temptations? A, the lead vocalist and guitarist of the Turtles fell off the stage 5 times. Was it B, the Temptations disbanded halfway through that concert? Was it C, Vietnam protesters were invited into the White House by Trisha Nixon? D, Vice President Spiro Agnew called in the National Guard to arrest the performers? Or E, all of the above happened on this day at the White House concert? And the correct answer is answer A. Mark Volman, vocalist, guitarist, and founder of the band The Turtles, fell off the stage 5 times during this concert, requested by Trisha Nixon. As noted in Audacity.com, what really happened when a 1960s rock group performed at the White House at the request of the first daughter and while the president was on an overseas trip? The Turtles were the favorite band of 24-year-old Trisha Nixon, and they were invited to play at a big party for Trisha at the White House. In the 1980s, there were the quote-unquote good boys and the quote-unquote bad boys. The Beatles and Herman's Hermits were considered quote-unquote good boys, while the Rolling Stones and the Animals were the quote-unquote bad boys of the British invasion. The Turtles were part of the Good Boys group, but their behavior at the White House on this day in 1969 would certainly have expelled them from that group. During their White House visit, the Turtles did drugs, got in trouble with the Secret Service, and had one of their members hit on Lucy Baines Johnson, daughter of the previous president, Lyndon Baines Johnson. The Turtles did not agree with the policies of Richard Nixon, but the band was encouraged by their management to perform at the White House, so they did. Upon arrival, the Secret Service was doing their job and inspecting the band's equipment when their electronic metronome accidentally turned on. When the Secret Service heard the ticking sound of the device, they pulled out their guns and tore apart the device before giving the all-clear signal. The Turtles were led to President Lincoln's library to use as their dressing room. The band had been drinking champagne and taking drugs at the hotel, which they continued doing at the White House. The band was buzzed, and here they were roaming around the most important home in America, unsupervised. The Temptations and Helen Reddy were also part of the lineup, and there were no problems with their performances. However, Mark Volman was so high that he fell off the stage an estimated 5 times, and the audience seemed quite amused. Volman also was seen trying to pick up Lucy Baines Johnson in the presence of her husband. The tense situation ended without everything getting out of control. President Nixon was on an overseas trip at the time of the concert. Otherwise, the band would probably have ended up in Gitmo. Meanwhile, the answer to our second question evidently involves one of the bad boys from Britain. So how did Mick Jagger of the Rolling Stones respond on this very day to the news of an earthquake in Nicaragua? Was it A, he wrote the song I Feel the Earth Move, which Carole King later recorded? Was it B, he performed Shake, Rattle, and Roll at a concert? Was it C, he added $150,000 of his own money to the $350,000 raised by a Rolling Stones benefit concert for the victims of the earthquake? Or D, he did all of the above on this day back in 1973? Correct answer? Answer C. He contributed $150,000 of his own money to bring the total contribution for victims of this earthquake to $500,000. Let's close out today's program with Buddy Holly's possible response to his rejection by Arthur Godfrey on this very day back in 1957. That'll be the day. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. This program's also available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. As we leave you now, remember these words: kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. The content of this program, intended for people who are blind or print impaired. If you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me at 919-832-5138. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Music Review, underwritten by Bill McClure. Tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning, please call 919-779-1755. So long, until next time. You know it's a lie, 'cause that'll be the day.